Okay, final hour here with David Paris. We're going to take your phone calls with him when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. David Paris with us. David, any idea where these craft might be originating from?
You mean as far as locations like Pleiades or something like that along those lines?
Mm-hmm.
That's really hard to speculate on. Obviously, if these craft have not been produced here, that they have to be coming from somewhere, and that would be a given. But could it be Alpha Centauri or Proxima Centauri or Gamma Epsilon, which is the Proxima Centauri and Alpha Centauri is about 5 light years away, and Gamma Epsilon is about 11 light years away, and those are our closest neighbors, per se. But then after that, we're going 30, 50, 100 light years out. So in order for craft like that, even doing light speed, they would have to be doing something far more than that to be practical.
Yeah.
It's, you know, just our radio emissions from the Earth reaches out about 107 years from the first Marconi transmission. And that really doesn't reach too far into space. And it's obviously the signal is extremely weak, but what I'm getting at is that 107 years of light speed of electromagnetic signals emanating from the Earth. And that's as far as we've gotten. So in order for this stuff to be practical, they have to be going, in order to get here to do what they do, they have to be going well beyond the speed of light to make it anything of a practical, unless it's all robotic craft. But then again, you look back at, well, if it takes them hundreds of years to get here or 50 light years to get here, by the time they return, the information is already 100 years old.
All right, let's go to the phones. Geneva, Ohio, John's turn. Hey, John, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Question I have is the system that you're working on, given all the background that you've got from the pilots, is the technology able to keep people alive at very fast speeds?
Yeah, actually, this revolves around an early theory in 1994 from Miguel Alcubierre, very famous and highly controversial among other scientists of whether space warp can actually exist or not on the amount of power levels. But what he had actually predicted in the theory would be that a bubble would protect the crew and from the momentum. And so therefore you could turn 90 degrees and not be, as they would refer to in the space program, spam in the can. And what we found with Bruce's encounter is that he had that slight hydroplaning feeling, but he also had that slight feeling of weightlessness. And with his linear displacement of approximately 100 miles, that he did not have any kind of physical ramifications of the actual space warp bubble. So it appears that the theoretical speculation from Alcubierre proved to be correct in that there wasn't any biological harm to the people.
Back to the calls we go. Let's go to Robert in Culver City, California now. Robert, it's your turn.
Yeah, George, hi, how you doing?
Good, Robert.
And David. Yeah, I talked to George once about this. When David was talking about what he was doing, it reminded me of an experience I had when I was a kid up in the Verdugo Hills. I think I told George about this. A couple of us kids, it was probably in the early 50s at the time, we're up at camp, and a couple of kids about twilight, I guess, said they had seen, did you see that? And I turned around and I said, see what? The guy said, there were about three or four kids behind us, three or four of us go ahead of them, heading up to our cabins. They said, we just saw about five or six silver discs fly into the canyon. And I said, well, we didn't see anything. We looked around, the guys ahead of us, people I was with, I said, we didn't see anything. And Went up to my cabin. Next morning, I woke up about twilight, just about the time light is starting to break through. It was dark still, but the light was starting to break through. And I heard what sounded like, you know, clanging chains, the whole thing. And the chains, it continued on. It appeared to me like it was like going on for about 45 minutes or so. It sounded like a manufacturing plant to me. I thought maybe there was a manufacturing plant somewhere down there, but also, you know, I was pretty interested in the UFO experience. I thought it was, you know, it was going on. I thought there was something to it. I mean, I believed it. But on the other hand, and I remembered what the kids had said the night before. So I heard those chains clanging again, and then I heard a thunderous sound. The sound died down, and it stopped for a while. Then I heard the chains clanging again for another 15 minutes or so, and then I heard this thunderous sound go on again. And then I kept looking straight ahead of me about 50 yards or so into the canyon because my cabin was situated where I could see the mountains in the distance, the Tonga Mountains, Big Tongas. And in the middle right below us was this canyon. So all of a sudden I looked up and the chains were clanging, and all of a sudden I saw this thunderous sound comes out. It sounded something like the rockets when they take off at Cape Canaveral. It went up about 50 to 100 feet over the top of the hills, and it just stopped there. We had green flames shooting out all around the whole circumference of the metallic object. It was all metallic. I didn't see any windows in it. It was metallic. It looked to be about 15 or so feet high, and possibly anywhere, because my distance, judging distances as far as sizes, at the time I'd say it was somewhere between 15 to 30 feet in diameter. I'm just guessing at that, but it wasn't more than 50 yards from me yet. And I looked at it, it just hung up in the air, and you could hear the rocking sound from its momentum. It obviously it was anti-gravity, I guess, because it would have fallen to the ground. And you know, I'm not a scientist, but I've been interested in it, and I've had a lot of math classes. I have a degree in accounting, but anyway, I was like interested and really fascinated by the UFO experience. And then all of a sudden, I saw this. It sounded like an elevator door when it opens, or it made a whooping sound, and it swung after it was facing me for about 10 minutes. It swung onto a 45-degree angle, about a 45-degree angle, and the flames were shooting out. I could see the back of it, and somebody asked me later what it looked like, and I said I thought it was like a convex, possibly. It looked like a net or something, a netting, and it looked like a rustic cabin on the back. But then as I looked closer, it looked like it might have been a refined plastic. It looked a little different as I kept looking at it. And then it shot out. It made a sputtering sound after it made that whooping sound and swung onto the 45-degree angle. It sounded like a motor scooter shooting out, and then it's something like what David said. It was kind of a mystery. It brought it to mind just now, but it looked like the front part of the craft. I only saw it for about 300 yards as it started to move. It was in a stationary position, and as it started to move, it looked like the front part was going to for some reason, I got the image that it was going to accelerate at a tremendous speed at some point.
Well, hold on. Take a breath here, Robert, for just a sec. I want to get your reaction, David, to some of this. It sounds like it could be earthbound. What do you think?
It sounds kind of like the Scirocco incident, where the kind of like an egg shape.
With a police officer.
With the flame coming out, and it had burnt the ground, and had to put out a fire there. They saw some like humanoid-like people get out of the craft, but I mean the way he describes the in the initial conversation that he had in his description sounded that's what popped into my mind, was like that egg-shaped type of craft with a landing gear on it, and it was, you know, had a actually like a rocket motor being able to control it up and down.
What's so amazing is how vivid some of these stories are, David.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, people may not understand the science behind it, but they certainly have eyes and ears and they can describe these observations. And it's very important to, you know, write these things down, collect them, because there is a trail, there is a tendency that one can get from this data. If we hadn't had these pilots, we would not been able to have figured out what really occurred with these things and then to actually artificially induce it to where we are today. You see, and that's one of the other things about science. I mean, let me give you a great example.
All right.
Roger Schauer developed an EM drive. He uses some microwave energy inside of a chamber. It's a thrusting engine. He introduced it in 2003, and everybody laughed at him. Now there's a paper that came out in early August of NASA confirms impossible thruster actually works, could revolutionize space travel. And we run into this over and over and over again, not just in the UFO community, but also in when people are introducing new science, new technology, where immediately the skeptics come out, the denials come out, and it's really an uphill battle. But here's a gentleman that developed an electromagnetic drive, an EM drive as they refer to it, and it doesn't use gas like an ion drive would, and it uses more energy than what we're using, and it doesn't have as much power as what have demonstrated with ours. However, here was a gentleman that introduced this in 2003, now has been vindicated in a sense by been vetted by NASA in this case. And, you know, we're facing the same uphill battle with this because we are not a named lab. We are independent, and we have developed, you know, what we have. And that's why we want to see it into the public domain.
Sure.
In a sense that, you know, we have patent pendings on the motor and other methodology and process. But the bottom line here is that we want this to be available in the private sector, privatization of space. We want to see space flourish and a whole new economy blossom from this, of mining in space, space stations, and all the other things that go with this. We just can't have one agency having this all wrapped up. It needs to become part of the economy of the United States. Spacefaring nation, this is where it's all at.
Let's go to Glenda in Lawrenceville, Georgia, east of the Rockies. Good morning, Glenda.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I appreciate all the information that we're getting tonight. It's a great show. I just want to preempt my question to David with this information that if we apply the laws of physics to a bumblebee, that theoretically it wouldn't fly.
Yeah.
So we realize
take that further to a hummingbird, and
right. With the low vibration that you hear with many situations with UFOs, could it be applied to the way the bumblebee flies, which is the low compression that is created by the sound or the torsion wave under the bumblebee from the wings? And would this compression cause change if you were to change the amplitude of the torsion wave with frequency adjustments? Could that cause something in a larger field to be propelled in another way?
In other words, to induce like a space warp.
Right, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. In this case, what we're really looking at is a physical ramification of the movement of wings in the air, and that's correct. It would compress the air around it, however, in this case, what we're actually doing is we're using electrical energy to create a very defined, compressed space that similar, I guess, if you wanted to use that type of terminology in reflecting against the bumblebee, but a similar type situation, except this is just using much more higher amount of power and scrunching up the space in front of this engine.
Charles Stern driving around somewhere in California. Charles, go ahead.
Hey, what's going on, David? First time caller. Yeah, actually, one of the other guys sort of snagged my question with the sort of gratification at going at those speeds. Because I used to work at the aerospace physiology at Beale Air Force Base in Chicago. But anyways, they still got an interesting story. This used to happen quite a bit over at Seymour Johnson Air Force Base when I was a kid. Because I would usually look up the sky and just sort of stare at the stars because that's sort of an eye-level window. And I thought I had seen sort of a shooting star, and then it started to slow down. And I'm like, okay, well, could it be an aircraft that's not blinking? And it sort of just hovered there for a few minutes and then started doing semicircles. And at this point, I had to go wake up my brother. I'm like, dude, you got to see this. So he came rushing in, and of course, it was still there doing semicircles and was doing a lot of just different acrobatic maneuvers, and finally just sort of hovered there and just as sort of in your experience, just shot up in the air and just disappeared. So I was sort of just amazed at, you know, and of course, it sort of happens quite a bit. And some of the pilots that I've talked to, they have sort of interesting stories they don't like to talk about too much, but because yeah, they're flying so high, they see a lot of those fun UFOs in the sky, of course. They don't.
Great story.
Well, you know, actually, you have in the Leap of Faith, astronaut Cooper, Gordon Cooper, who
he spotted some,
openly discussed the flight of these things that he was scrambled to go up and to look at, reported this to the United, actually gave a presentation to the United Nations, and that's another.
And they confiscated his pictures, didn't they?
When he was out into out in, I believe it was March Air Force Base, where they're doing some testing on aircraft, that a film crew actually photographed or filmed a UFO landing. And that's right. He looked at some of the film, and he asked directions on to from higher-ups on what do you do, and they processed the film there. He looked at some of the strip of film, and then he sent it off, but they never heard again from that. And it's kind of disquieting that pilots are in fear of their jobs for reporting these things. And I know a lot of pilots, once they're retired, they spill the beans, but it would be more effective if we could get this stuff early on when it actually occurs and happens, so we can catalog the information and then try to glean information from that, from trends and tendencies. I mean, there's obviously more than one type of craft. There's more than the one that I saw. Although we do see this repeatedly through from 69 to 93 to 2001, that same craft that I saw in Budapest, Hungary, reconnaissance aircraft took a photo of it. Actually, George, you have in your database there a photo from Vermont from 93 that shows a craft like that I saw coming over a mountain range, and the driver happened to take photos of it. But, I mean, so those particular styles of craft have been spotted over and over again, the triangle type craft, the boomerang type craft. So I would just say, from perspective on that, is that the various types of craft means that there's more than likely coming from different places.
Indeed. We shall be back with final calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And stick with us all week long for some great Coast to Coast programs. And when we come back in a moment with David Paris, we shall take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, David Paris with us. David, it seems that a lot of people are seeing a lot of different kinds of craft. And as you were just saying before the break, they could be coming from all over the place.
Yes. Yeah. And I, you know, that's how I have to kind of interpret it, unless we're building this craft here. But their performance and the type of actions that they do in the sky, I guess the bottom line would be, why are we developing all the stealth fighters, the bombers, and we're investing all these billions of dollars in all this hardware if we actually had this stuff to use? Is this an imbalance of power? I mean, if we can do this, then certainly other people around the world would do the same thing. You know, people are pretty bright no matter what country that they're located in. So I guess that's always the big issue that I have, is that if the government really had all this stuff, then why aren't we using it?
Let's go to Jim now in Houston, Texas, to get this segment rolling here. Jim, go ahead.
Hey, fantastic show as always.
Thank you.
I had a two-part question. You were talking about the time lag. So I was wondering, as an example, the ship that you saw many years ago for 45 seconds, what if they just slowed down their warp engine, but they were actually watching you for about 3 hours? And then also, have you been able to figure out the pinpoint or the formula to get from point A to point B without ending up in a wall or a mountain, or vice versa? Have you intentionally tried to get stuck in a wall or a mountain?
We're actually going to do an experiment on Friday where we're going to take some fog from a fog machine, and we're going to have a horizontal laser, and we're going to put two opposing motors to each other and look at the fields it generates. In other words, see what happens, how the smoke splits and all that. Now, as far as going into a wall, that's not one of our objectives, but we have a whole series of equations that define the motor and the near field, which is kind of a nebulous thing when you're dealing in that kind of arena. If you look up the definitions on it, but I actually have the formulas now that we've developed that actually can define the opening, and it's very precise. We also have the compression metric density formulas, and we also are working on, and almost to the conclusion of, the reach or the fetch formula, which will then tell us how far the compression of space is in front of the actual engine itself. And this then gives us all the variabilities of power and angle and frequency and all the other variables that would go into the design of a bigger, heftier motor. So this is just the beginning. And like I said, 2 months ago, it was real exciting to push out this new one, which doubled the output capacity. Now I'm looking to times that times four with the next one. And onward and upward to, as Captain James Kirk would say, more power, Scotty. That's what we're after, is more power.
Do you think, what would happen if some major company, oil company, came and wanted to just buy you out, David, and shut it down?
That's why we are talking on the air tonight, is that that's not going to happen. This needs to be in, and the public be made aware that this does exist. And we will persevere, and we will see this to fruition. If it takes me another 10 years, work in another couple of colleges to raise more money, that's what I'll have to do. Our crowdfunding is, we're leaving it up to the public. If the public feels that this is a worthwhile project, then, you know, they want to donate $10 into the fund for this thing to get it off the ground, and so we can advance and actually get a craft into space. That's what this is all about. And we don't want to see somebody trying to come in and take this away. That's why we're doing our patents and protecting not just the intellectual property, but we also want to protect and provide this technology for the privatization of space. It will boom this economy. Everybody's looking for more jobs. There isn't a better place to do it than going to space and developing and evolving, not just space travel, but or hotels in space and space stations. But I'm talking mining. We need a lot of different materials here on planet Earth. We're running out of. You go to the asteroid belt. You go to the moon. You collect helium-3. It's a real very great resource that we need to fuel fusion reactors once we get those things perfected. We need an abundance of energy, and that's really what this has come down to. And we need also the materials to do this, to be an advanced civilization. And space is the way to do this. And you got to have some kind of a practical motor that can get out there and get to places quickly and bring the materials back to Earth for the processing and then the manufacturing end of it.
Let's go to Terry in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Terry. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, George. How you doing?
Good. Thank you.
Good morning, David. David, a while ago you was talking about Alpha Centauri.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, watch it lost in space. That was the star that the Jupiter 2 was going to.
That's correct.
And, you look at the Star Trek, the cell phone comes to that. Now we got sliding doors like the turbo ship. Does your ship look like something like the Jupiter 2?
No, actually, it is a remnant of the XPRIZE competition. I had designed a craft, and I actually built the model, put it in the wind tunnel. It's a high bypass winged lifting body. So it looks kind of like a shuttle. There's pictures of it onto the website, and I've adapted that. It's a handmade craft. It's taken me thousands of hours to build. It's all made out of aluminum. And this particular craft is 7x7. It's a quarter scale of the actual full-size craft that we intend to build. That would be 30x30. And that would hold 7 people on board. And, of course, there are tremendous amounts of adaptations to this. You can stretch it. You know, you can put more people in there and whatnot. But the whole idea is, I guess if you looked at it from straight on, it kind of looks like a flying saucer in a way. But actually, it's a flyable craft, and it has positive dihedral in the wings. And I purposely designed it that way so that I would not have to use sophisticated computers for the flight control systems. I really get nervous when an F-117 and a B-2 bomber, you got to fly it by computer. I know they have redundant systems in that. However, inherent stability in a craft is far superior than having a computer control all this stuff, because there's definitely situations that when everything else fails and you know you can depend back onto the inherent stability of the craft, that's the way I want to go. That's my ultimate backup system. This thing will take off like an elevator, and you go to space, you re-enter that way, but if something fails, you got to have a backup. And we also have a design for ionized leading edges onto the wing that will ionize air and actually create like an ablated situation so that if you had to come back through the atmosphere, that you could ablate the high temperature heats of like up to 9,000 degrees over the wings without this thing melting. And so, you know, we've got a lot of things, our concepts, and we've also proven this in the lab on how that works, and we're going to integrate this into the actual full live craft.
Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. It's John's turn on Coast to Coast. John, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, George. Thanks for taking the call. I thought I'd throw a ringer in here to y'all.
All right.
You know, there's a lot of trash and a lot of satellites around the Earth. If I was a pilot trying to get in here, it'd be really difficult. And that's why I believe that they're coming in through here through wormholes, because in 1985, I'm a trucker. I've been out here for about 40 years. And 1985, coming out of Van Horn, Texas, on Interstate 10, at mile marker 173, on the south side of the highway, there's a mesa up there about 500 yards. And it's about a quarter mile wide, quarter mile long. And I saw a ship take off from there at 11 o'clock in the morning. It was overcast everywhere. And when you get that high up the mountain, you're going up a mountain when you're going east, coming out of Van Horn. And when you get that high up, you can see almost forever. And it was totally overcast, except right over that top of that mesa. And it was open. There was an open space there. And the clouds were enfolding into themselves, holding this hole open, you know, like around the edges. It'd just be enfolding into itself, just holding the clouds back. And this ship was, it's like you'd take two cigars and put them together and make a plus sign.
Yeah.
And there was no windows. There was no doors. There was a light coming off of it like it was fluorescent light, but it wasn't a light. It wasn't fluorescent. I mean, it was a strange colored light. And it was silver like aluminum, but it wasn't aluminum. It just didn't look like aluminum, but it was silver. And it didn't seem like it wasn't in no big hurry. I was stopped on the side of the road, and I was watching it. And it just lifted up like, you know, it wasn't in no big hurry. And it went through that hole in the clouds. And as soon as it went through that hole in the clouds, that hole closed up like if you ever saw Alien, the first one, when Dallas stepped through that hatch and it closed up behind him, like in a circle, like it had a pivot point right in the middle, and it closed down. That's the way that hole closed, which leads me to believe that they're using wormholes. I don't think they could get in here through with all the satellites and everything that are around the Earth. You'd have to be a real good jockey to get in here through all this stuff.
What do you think of the wormhole theory, David?
Well, theoretically, it's possible. I know it would require a lot of energy to keep a wormhole open, but who knows the kind of energy that a craft has from a different part of the outside of the solar system, if that indeed is where it's coming from. I always leave the door open. You know, Carl Sagan used that in Contact as a mechanism to get Jodie Foster from one place to the other in a very quick manner, and they built a big, huge machine. But it is possible. I mean, Einstein accounts for that as well. The space warp seems to be the most reasonable for the power levels that one would need to create a bubble. The wormhole, I really haven't touched that one at all, and probably won't because I'm so occupied with this. But as far as is it possible, yeah, I would definitely leave the door open, yeah.
Let's go to Bob in El Paso, Texas, wildcard line. Bob, go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, Bob.
Love the show.
I'm right
with you on this. I was one of the guys that helped work with the ion engine when they sent it out into space with Raytheon. And what I was thinking about when you were talking about your engine is what we were going to do with ours is put engines in line, in series, one after the other. What would happen if you did that with your engine, put one in front of the other?
Well, actually,
so that each one fed into the next.
Yeah, I actually have a what we call as a quad array, and I had mentioned a little bit ago about putting turbochargers on the motor. In reality, what we've got is we have another set of fractal arrays of panels, and they sit up on top of the dual array, and you actually have what we refer to as a quad. But you can shift those back and forth over the field, and what it does is it pre-compresses the fabric of space and then compresses it once more into the other panel. And we have experimented with that, and it's interesting because from the standpoint that we can manipulate the fields and strengthen them on one side and lower them on the other. And that's in addition to warping space, you also have to be able to warp the field. So, yes, we have actually done what you're suggesting by putting those extra panels up off the main part of the motor. And it does work.
A couple more minutes left. We'll go to Sue in Oregon. Sue, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, I was just wondering, Bill and Linda Gates sometimes donate money to different things, and I just wondered if you maybe filled out some papers and sent it to them.
How about the Gates getting you financed here, David?
Well, from my understanding of a lot of those funding programs that they have, is that it usually doesn't include technology like what we're discussing here. That's always been like a limiting factor. I've looked at a lot of these things in the past, and it's always been, well, you know, it's for this particular thing and that particular thing, but it really never revolves around technology. And that was kind of a disappointing thing. That's why I haven't ever pursued that. The crowdfunding seems to be, from my perspective, probably the best source right now because people don't have to contribute much of anything. You know, they can contribute $1, $5, $10, and as you go up, there are perks of getting a patch, a T-shirt. But you know, the way we have this thing set up is that obviously if you contributed $100, you're not going to get a warp drive motor. I mean, some crowdfunding, you actually get a piece of hardware, you know, maybe a CD, a movie, a radio, or a 3D printer if you put in enough money into the thing. But unfortunately, in our particular case, we would prefer to have the excitement of people that want to participate and be part of this and put all their names onto a flash drive and put it on the first Faster Than Light craft, or put their name onto the actual Bluebird for our UAV and have their names put on it. That way there's people have more of a connection to this.
David, would you give out your website, which I think we may have crashed for you tonight?
They've crashed. Well, I'm sure our webmaster, Chris, he would probably be up there tonight and trying to fix that.
I think
But the website is the www.parisspacewarpresearch.org.
Super. Well, best wishes to you in getting this motor rolling, and you know, who knows what the future will hold for us in that arena. David, thank you so much. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.